This episode cannot prove its own consistency.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 8 of the Beyond Podcast, the podcast that is also questing for the essence of mind and pattern. This is a podcast for anyone who has had to deal with the treachery of determining what is and is not a pipe.
Hi, folks. Welcome back. My name is Vadim, and I'll be your host again. Welcome to the podcast that discusses meta concepts. Let's start off by doing something that's not quite a thought experiment, but a visualization exercise that will hopefully build up to something interesting. Feel free to close your eyes and picture what I'm describing, unless you're currently operating a vehicle. If you happen to be a passenger in a robot-operated taxi, you're in the right place to do this.
Hey, look, Homer's got one of those robot cars.
So imagine that you're in a house and there are several rooms of the type that you would expect, like a living room, several bedrooms, a kitchen, and so on. You are free to move around from room to room. They're all ultimately accessible. Maybe the house is big enough to where there are multiple paths to get from the kitchen to the living room and from there to the bedroom. Now imagine that this house, the overall building, contains another set of rooms completely blocked off from the ones that you're currently in. That separate living area also has multiple bathrooms and bedrooms and a kitchen. Someone can walk around freely in that section of the house, just as you are free to move around in yours.
I honestly don't know how I got out of there. The upstairs hallway spiraled into a black hole, and the weather kept changing, and I was a child again.
However, the two sections are isolated from each other. You might say that your kitchen, let's call it kitchen A, is not reachable from kitchen B. Why would you build a house this way? I don't know. Maybe you want to rent half of it out, and this way your renters can have complete privacy. Of course, if something goes wrong in the other part of the house, you can't just easily walk over there and fix it. You have to physically leave the house and re-enter it somewhere else. But it doesn't quite end there. After you spend some time exploring many rooms that are accessible to you, you conclude that your house is infinite in its extent. You can keep finding more and more rooms if you look in the right places. However, no matter how many rooms you discover, there is always that other part of the house that is not reachable from any of the infinite number of rooms that are accessible to you. And there's more. This weird house is even weirder than you realize. When you look out of your many, many windows, you see another house on the opposite side of the street. That house is also infinite in size and has two fully separate sections. Occasionally, when you look through the window, you see a person in the other house who looks just like you, except it's plainly obvious that they're your evil twin. I mean, just look at that goatee.
The professor's right. You are evil. And shallow. I am not evil.
The visual metaphor that I'm trying to build, and feel free to tell me later if you think it's not a good metaphor, it is meant to put down some groundwork for eventually discussing the central thesis of Godel-Escherbach, which is, of course, Godel's incompleteness theorems. So how is this supposed to work? Let's put some stuff in our house, because it's currently rather empty. And to find things of interest for the house, let's start with a formal system, such as the rules of arithmetic. That's right, instead of furniture and family photos, we'll be filling up our house with mathematical statements. Maybe we'll artistically draw them on the walls. So normally when we learn arithmetic in school, we don't start with formalisms. Instead, we learn some tricks for manipulating numbers and equations. However, the underlying rules are always present. There are many ways to formalize these rules. However, I'm going to refer to a specific formulation, which is Peano's axioms. That's P-E-A-N-O, after Giuseppe Peano, an important and influential mathematician who was active in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. There were also other contemporary folks working on similar ways to formalize the rules of mathematics. But let's focus on what Peano came up with. He was trying to formalize arithmetic such that you could start off with a small set of rules that you take as a given. These are axioms. And from those, you could derive and prove many other interesting facts about natural numbers. These are numbers like 0, 1, 2, and so on. Let's take a look at these basic rules. The first axiom is really straightforward. We start off by saying that 0 is a natural number. We then add the second axiom, which states that for every natural number x, x is equal to itself. So far, so good?
Oh, does that confuse you?
The next axiom states that for all natural x and y, if x is equal to y, then y is equal to x. Sounds reasonable to me. Now, before we explore some more of these axioms, let's go back to our lovely house. Let's take each one of Piano's axioms and give it its own room in our house. Perhaps the first axiom that tells us that zero is a natural number can be right in the lobby where we take off our shoes. The second axiom can be in the kitchen, and the third axiom can be in the living room. The fourth axiom, which states that for all natural numbers x, y, and z, if x equals y and y equals z, then x equals z. Well, this axiom can transit over to the guest room. The fifth axiom can have the main bedroom. This one tells us that for all a and b, if b is a natural number and a is equal to b, then a is also a natural number. There are a few more of these axioms, and we have plenty of rooms for those as well. Now, when the axioms move into our house, they may be a little confused by our convention of naming rooms with labels like the lobby or the main bedroom. So for the convenience of our guests, we can also number our rooms like 0, 1, 2, and so on. In fact, the sixth axiom, which we haven't mentioned yet, can really help us with this numbering scheme. This is the axiom that establishes the existence of the so-called successor function. For every natural number n, S of n is a natural number. Intuitively, this is just like adding 1 to get the next number. The successor of 0, or S of 0, is 1, S of 1 is 2, and so on. After our guests move in, and there are a total of 9 of them initially, we can give them a day or two to get settled in. Then the work begins. Now that we have Piano's axioms all living under one roof, we might wonder what other truths about mathematics we can derive from them. Turns out we can derive a lot of other truths. We can derive addition and multiplication, and if we bring in some extra tools from logic and set theory, we can derive many, many additional truths from our initial axioms. In fact, there's an infinite number of truths that can be formulated from these initial axioms.
Why, there's a whole universe in there! Dude, there's a universe in all of us.
Now, many of these truths might be redundant or tautological, but many are also subtle and complex, such as proofs within number theory. These infinite truths are represented in our house analogy by the infinite number of reachable rooms. So far in this thought exercise, we populated the house with Piano's axioms, but we could have started with the axioms of any consistent formal system and proceeded to fill the house to infinity with true statements that are provable using the rules of that consistent formal system. But what actually counts as a consistent formal system? Well, the consistency part is easier to think about. It's really about lack of contradictions. A statement made within the formal language of the system and its negation cannot both be part of the system. Something can't be both true and false at the same time. Of course, there are various notions and levels of consistency, but you get the general idea. What about the definition of a formal system? Well, we normally think of mathematics and logic, but what we're really after is a system that has language and syntax and a way of forming valid expressions via the system's grammar. And for this discussion, we're interested in formal systems where the grammar allows for an infinite number of expressions or statements to be generated, such that we could reason in some way about the truth or validity of these statements. And if all this talk of syntax and formal grammar makes you think of computer programming languages and their rules, that is no coincidence. We will discuss some very interesting parallels between mathematical formal systems and computer programs. But let's not yet neglect our infinite mansion. We've sketched out how we can start with some finite number of axiomatic guests in finite rooms and fill the rest of the house out to infinity. Well, what about the adjacent part of the house that we said is not reachable from anywhere within our house? What about that other kitchen over there on the other side of the wall? And what about that weird sort of identical house across the street where your almost certainly evil twin is standing in the window looking at you menacingly?
We change Hugo up in the attic like an animal and fed him a bucket of fish heads once a week.
First, let's address the house across the street. If your part of your house is filled with all the truths reachable from your system's axioms, then the house across the street is filled with all the untruths. That is, every statement that can be made in your formal system that can be proven to not be true, or in other words, false, well, every such statement is taking up a room in the part of the other house where your twin is. And there's also an infinite number of such untruths. But what's important to remember here is this. In your part of the house, there are truths that are provable within the system.
That equals true.
In your twin's part of the house across the street, all the untruths are also capable of being proven to be false within the system. So your twin may not necessarily actually be evil. They're just sort of opposite-ish from you in every way, but otherwise made from the same exact stock.
I tell you, they're not evil. But don't be confused. They are jerks.
So if you're still with me for this house analogy, what do we make of the unreachable parts of both your house and the one across the street? Just like you, your maybe not really evil upon further consideration twin has a whole infinite part of their house which they cannot reach. What do those rooms represent? Let's actually hold on to that thought for a moment. Everything we discussed so far about formal systems and infinite provable statements doesn't feel very meta, right? After all, given some syntax and grammar, you could probably devise a mechanistic way of generating an infinite number of statements that are valid, but not especially interesting. For example, you could trivially say that 1 equals 1 and 2 equals 2 and so on, out to infinity. Or in the language of piano arithmetic, you could say that the successor of 0 is equal to the successor of 0, and the successor of the successor of 0 is equal to the successor of the successor of 0, and so on, and crank out these statements until the heat death of the universe. Like we said, not very meta. So I want to get to where this does get meta, and how we can enter the unreachable part of the house. But before we can do that, let's pivot into a book review and hopefully another fun puzzle. In fact, let's start with the puzzle. This one was submitted by listener Ed in Berkeley, California, who also recommended the book that I will mention shortly. Now, this particular puzzle, it really tickled my fancy, especially for this podcast. If you recall, in episode 7, we had discussed various scenarios where, to solve a problem, you have to know what the other player knows, and also know that they know that you know, and so on. We also briefly mentioned Douglas Hofstadter's concept of super-rationality. Yes, that guy again. As a refresher, here's what Hofstadter had in mind. Quote, "Super-rational thinkers, by recursive definition, include in their calculations the fact that they are in a group of super-rational thinkers." Now, with that definition in mind, let's get to the puzzle that Ed mentioned. This puzzle was known as the Blue Eyes Problem, or sometimes as the Blue Eyes Island. There are many write-ups of this puzzle on the internet, and it just so happens that XKCD's Randall Monroe, yes, that guy again.
Yes, that guy again.
Had at one point produced a very concise and clear write-up of this puzzle on xkcd.com. A link to this write-up is available in the transcript of this episode, which itself is available at thebeyondpod.com. So let me paraphrase it for you here. You see, there's this island where a group of very clever people live. All of these folks are perfect logicians, or in Hofstadter's parlance, you can think of them as perfectly super-rational thinkers. What it means is that anything that can be deduced from evidence, they will deduce instantly. And if by the deeper property of super-rationality, if person A deduces something due to information that's available to them, and person B somehow learns that person A was able to make that deduction, then person B can immediately compute the implications of this.
I am too smart! I am too smart!
And of course, person A knows a priori that person B would be able to deduce this. It's turtles all the way down. Thanks, recursion. However, despite their deductive cleverness, these people are not allowed to communicate with each other under any circumstances. Also, while they can plainly observe all the other inhabitants on this island, they are unable to see themselves. Sorry, no mirrors. And therefore, they do not know the color of their own eyes. Every night a fairy comes to the island. Any islanders that somehow have correctly figured out their own eye color can leave the island that night. Everyone else stays behind. Everyone knows the rules. You know the rules, and so do I. At the start of this puzzle, there are 100 blue-eyed people on the island and 100 people with brown eyes. There's also one guru. She has green eyes and she's the only one that's allowed to speak. So any random blue-eyed person would look around and see 99 blue-eyed people, 100 brown-eyed people, and the guru. However, they don't know the overall eye color distribution, and therefore they cannot initially conclude anything about their own eye color. For all they know, they could have red eyes. The same goes for any brown-eyed person. They would see 99 brown-eyed people, 100 blue-eyed people, and of course the green-eyed guru, but that tells them nothing about their own eye color. One day, the guru goes before the rest of the islanders and speaks. She says, "I can see someone who has blue eyes. The question is, based on this bit of information, who will leave the island and on what night?" The usual disclaimers apply. No cheating, no secret communication, no body language, no mirrors, no gazing into reflective pools. The answer is purely logical. And yes, it is possible to leave the island. The guru's message, stated more formally, is, "I count at least one blue-eyed person who is not me." Fun puzzle, right? Email me at thebeyondpod@gmail.com to discuss the answer or if you need some hints. Of course, the solution is well documented on various sites if you want to look it up. We'll discuss the solution on one of the next episodes, and it will be obvious why it fits so well with the kinds of topics that are discussed on this podcast. I also promised to talk about a book. This one was also recommended by Ed. The title of this book is, "What is the name of this book?" You can see why this was immediately appealing. And if that doesn't instantly hook you, what if I told you that the book has an endorsement from Willard Von Orman Quine, the very person after whom Douglas Hofstadter, yes again, named Quines, computer programs that reproduce their own source code? We talked a lot about those in episode one, which of course was the second episode of the podcast. In this house, we use natural numbers.
In this house, we obey the laws of thermodynamics!
So this book was published in 1978, authored by Raymond Smullyan, who was an American polymath who worked in the field of logic and formal systems. Ah, how it all comes together. The book contains 200 puzzles and riddles, as well as discussions of paradoxes in logic and set theory. So to whet your appetite, there are puzzles with titles like Knights and Knaves and Alice in the Forest of Forgetfulness. Also, The Mystery of Portia's Caskets and Is Dracula Still Alive? This really is a fun read if you're into that sort of thing. Are you into that sort of thing? Oh, and there are also solutions and explanations included. Thanks again to listener Ed for the recommendation. So, where were we? Ah yes, back to our two weird houses. Time to address the elephant in the unreachable room. First, let's look at some quirks of the way we had filled the reachable part of our house. We started with a set of axioms, things we took for granted to be true. Then we systematically applied rules to come up with new true statements within our formal system. These also belong to our side of the house. Given some axioms and a chain of valid steps used to arrive at a new true statement, it should be obvious that the new statement, in fact, is true. In fact, the process of validating a proof is rather mechanical and could be executed on a computer, by a computer. All you have to do is validate that each step of the proof follows from the previous steps under the rules of the system. If each step is valid, then the conclusion is also valid and true. However, in this mechanistic process, we have the advantage of having the full trail from the axioms to the final statement, and we just have to follow along. Well, what if we don't have a trail? What if a new statement shows up on our metaphorical block with the two houses? Now you and your, let's stop calling them evil twin, need to make a decision together, as good neighbors ought to. Does this new statement belong in your house, where all true statements live? Or does it belong across the street in the house where your twin lives? Specifically, the part of the house where all false statements live. Surely it must belong to one or the other group, right? Well, it turns out this is a much, much harder problem than just validating a proof. It took mathematicians a while to figure this out, but in the most general case, this is an undecidable problem. If you like German, this entails a negative answer to the Entscheidungsproblem, or the decision problem. There is no algorithm that can reliably prove or disprove all well-formed statements within a formal system. However, this does not mean that an algorithm cannot prove some statements. So a statement could arrive on your block, and maybe you make it wait outside for a little while you let your algorithm run. You and your twin eagerly await the answer. Maybe you have a rule when you give your algorithm exactly 1 hour and no more. If within the hour the algorithm halts and gives a true or false answer, then you allow the statement to either enter your house or your twin's house. Maybe you don't like the idea of leaving statements out in the cold forever. Maybe you're willing to let the algorithm run even longer until it spits out true or false.
It could take an hour, or it could take 100 million years.
Unfortunately, the situation is worse than we described. It's not just a matter of time and computer resources. Enter Kurt Gödel and Alan Turing. Let's start with Turing.
He's also from X-Men.
Like many of you listening to this episode, Turing was also concerned about whether the truth of mathematical statements was always decidable. He came up with an analogous problem in the realm of computer science. Instead of thinking about provable mathematical statements, let us consider computer programs. Now, computer programs can compute many sorts of things, but let us ignore what it is they're actually computing, as well as the output they produce, and focus on a much simpler question. Given a particular computer program, written in a particular programming language, and given the input to that computer program, can we determine whether the program will eventually stop or will it go on forever? And by saying, can we determine, what I really mean is, can we come up with some mechanical way of doing this? For example, can we write another computer program, let's call it halting checker, and this halting checker takes as its input a pair of values, the source code of some valid computer program, and some input to that program. And then halting checker inspects the source code and the input and makes a determination about whether the program whose source code we're looking at will loop forever or complete after some finite number of steps. Let's look at two very simple examples using Python as our reference language. The first program's source code is print hello world. The second program is just two lines. The first line is while true, and then the second line is pass. The first program, as you may have guessed, just prints out the string hello world to the output and then immediately halts. The second program loops forever. The fact that neither of these programs takes any actual input makes it easier to reason about the outcome. So obviously, from just a direct reading of the code, we can say with certainty which program behaves which way. Turing then asked a more general question. Does there exist an algorithm that can always make such a determination for any program we submit for analysis? And spoiler alert, no such algorithm exists. Before we look at a sketch of a proof, let's make a connection between something like the halting checker program and theorems about numbers. If you recall, in episode 3 of the podcast, we talked about how computer programs can be thought of as natural numbers. As a reminder, we can take a computer program written in your favorite programming language and convert it to a number using whatever reasonable encoding scheme we want. We could just consider the text of the program as a sequence of ones and zeros and interpret those ones and zeros as the digits of a binary number. For example, the character p, that's lowercase p, in the program print hello world has the ASCII code of 112, which in binary is 0111000. I added the extra zero at the front to pad us out to 8 bits so we get a full byte. And then we tack on the bits for the character R and so on, making our number bigger and bigger. All in all, the Hello World program in Python is made up of 20 characters, not counting the new line at the end. This would make for a binary number with 160 digits. And although this is a huge number, it's just a natural number, no more special than 0, 1, or 42. So to ask a question about this program's behavior, specifically whether it terminates or not, is equivalent to asking a question about the properties of the corresponding natural number that represents this program. By proving that no algorithm exists to answer such a question for all valid programs, we're also saying that there are some true-false questions about natural numbers that cannot be answered mechanically for all numbers. So how do we prove that such an algorithm cannot exist? Well, the formal proof requires us to think about both a program and its input, but it's far simpler to think about just programs that take no input. Consider the following program, which I will again express in Python. Let us first assume that we have already built a halting checker subroutine that returns true or false, and in the simplified example, only takes a program as its input. So what we have is a new routine, which I called R, Romeo, just the letter R. The body of this routine is this. We pass the routine R itself as an argument to the routine called halting checker. If halting checker returns true, meaning the routine ought to halt, then we enter an infinite loop. Otherwise, we halt. By the way, the tiny four-line source code I just described is available in this episode transcript at thebeyondpod.com. Okay, so what have we done here? Well, this is a proof by contradiction. So initially, we assume that halting checker does exist. We then write a new program, which I called R, that uses the halting checker internally. And we invoke halting checker with this program R as its input. Now, this might sound circular, but programming languages do allow us to make this kind of self-reference. So what is the overall behavior of this program R? Does it terminate or does it run forever? Well, there's the trick. If program R terminates, that means that internally the call to halting checker R must have returned false. But that means that R does not terminate. And if instead we say that the program R runs forever, that means that internally the call to halting checker of R must have returned true, meaning that R ought to halt. So this is obviously a contradiction.
Nice try, but my head was built with paradox-absorbing crumple zones.
And the resolution is that a general halting checker routine that works for all possible inputs cannot exist. It's also nice and meta because the contradiction arises when the halting checker is applied to itself in the context of program R. And the overall observation, and of course there are stronger mathematical proofs of this, but this insight finally put a nail in the coffin of the Entscheidungsproblem. There are questions that we can ask about natural numbers that are just not decidable. So finally, let us get back to our houses. What does this all mean for the fate of new statements that need to find a home? Enter Kurt Gödel. Gödel was looking at formal systems in terms of consistency and completeness. He came up with a mechanism to construct valid mathematical statements within a formal system that were, by construction, not provable within that system. For this, he used a contradiction trick similar to the halting problem. Now, the trick is much harder to describe than the R program I mentioned above. By the way, I called it R for reverser because this program basically reverses whatever the outcome of the halting checker routine was.
Pretty sneaky, sis.
So how do you construct something like this if you're working in the realm of math formulas? Just like Turing was able to represent computer programs as natural numbers, so was Gödel able to encode formulas as natural numbers. I should mention that Turing's encoding was not based on a particular modern programming language mapped to ASCII, mapped to binary, like our Python example from earlier. Instead, Turing's encoding started with a standard normalized representation of a Turing machine, with a fixed alphabet of symbols, an enumeration of possible states, the initial state, a state transition table, and a few other parameters. This combination of parameters, a 7-tuple, could then be encoded into binary using some mechanical scheme by assigning so many bits to each part of the tuple, and using unary encoding for some values, and using special bit sequences as separators, and so on. The details of the scheme are not super important. There are many valid possible encodings. Similarly, you might want to figure out how to take a statement like, quote, there does not exist an X such that 0 is the successor of X, and convert it into a natural number. As you can imagine, in formal systems, there are standard notations and symbols for expressing such a statement. For example, given this particular statement in English, you might encode it as the following. So what I have in the transcript is the symbol for all, which is just this cool-looking upside-down A, And then I have the symbol X, then colon, then the logical symbol for not, then capital S, followed by left parenthesis, then X, then the right parenthesis, then the equal sign, and then finally zero. All in all, 10 symbols. Now, there are many valid ways to convert this logic statement into a natural number. For example, in Good Ol' Escher Bach, our friend Douglas Hofstadter invents a so-called TNT, or typographical number theory, with its own set of symbols, which is nevertheless as expressive as piano arithmetic. There are symbols like there exists, and for all, and not, and parentheses, and so on. And for each of these symbols, the TNT encoding scheme provides a three-digit codon, which is a cool idea borrowed from biology of DNA or RNA molecules. And these codons can just be stringed together to convert a TNT statement into a number. For example, the for all symbol is given the codon 626. So if you write down a TNT statement using our familiar symbols and then just read it from left to right, converting each symbol into its three-digit codon, when you're done with the encoding, you end up with a very large natural number with a number of digits proportional to the length of the encoded statement, with three digits per symbol. And the way Gödel proposed to encode formulas was also very clever. Again, you build an alphabet of all the symbols in your formal system, and you assign a number to each symbol. For example, the symbol for zero might be assigned the number one. The equal sign might be assigned the number two, and so on. Then you use prime numbers to do the encoding. This is really cool. For example, the simple statement 0 = 0 has three symbols in it. So we take the first three prime numbers, which are 2, 3, and 5, and line them up with the three symbols of our statement. And then we raise each prime number to the power of the number that we assigned to each symbol. So with symbol 0 associated with the number 1, and the equal sign having the number 2, we would get 2 to the first, 3 squared, and 5 to the first. So the exponents are 1, 2, and 1. Matching our symbols of 0, equals, and 0. We then multiply everything together, which gives us 2 times 9 times 5, which is 90. So the natural number 90 can be interpreted as the Gödel encoding of the statement 0 equals 0. Note that we can easily decode 90 by finding all of its prime factors and then listing them in order. So 90 is 2 to the first times 3 squared times 5 to the first. We then read off the exponents 1, 2, 1, and convert them back to our symbols, which are 0 equals 0. Gödel then did something very meta with this way of representing formulas as natural numbers. Since piano arithmetic gives us a way of reasoning about natural numbers, and we can turn statements within piano arithmetic into natural numbers, we can construct formulas which simultaneously operate at two levels of abstraction. On one level, these are statements about properties of some natural number, like saying something about the number 90. On another level, since this natural number encodes a statement within piano arithmetic, then the statement which contains this number is a statement about a statement. Now, using this meta self-reference construction, Gödel created a recipe for constructing statements that in essence say, this statement, referring to itself, is not provable in piano arithmetic. This leads to a contradiction analogous to the one in the halting problem. It means that we were able to construct something in piano that is by construction not provable within piano. Therefore, we have to either accept or reject this as a new axiom. We cannot ever construct a proof starting with the original axioms that will converge on the Gödel statement, at least not within the first-order logic of piano arithmetic. So if one of these Gödel sentences appears on our block, which house do we stick it in?
Excuse me, sir. Might I have a sip of booze?
Finally, we can unfold the rest of the house metaphor. If the part of the house where you hang out is full of provable truths, and your twin's dwelling and all its reachable rooms is full of provable falsehoods, then the unreachable part of your house is where all the unprovable or unreachable truths go, and the other part of your twin's house is all the unreachable falsehoods. There's a great illustration of this idea on page 71 of Gödel Escher Bach. with the white silhouette of a tree encompassing all the provable theorems against the dark background of all the unprovable truths, and adjacent to it, there is a black silhouette of a tree that's encompassing the negations of all the theorems against the white background of all the undisprovable falsehoods. Unfortunately, this does not help us give all possible statements their preferred lodging within our two houses.
I'm sorry, Tenet Tim. Seems we ran out early tonight.
We just have to live with the fact that these things may not always be decidable, and just take the one-star reviews these statements will give us due to our bad hosting. Of course, we could always just try blaming everything on our evil twin. All right, so I think we made it. Of course, there's a lot more to be said about Turing and Godot's discoveries and their implications, but let's save that for a future episode. For now, thank you as always for listening. The transcript of this episode is available at thebeyondpod.com. And of course, you can email me at thebeyondpod@gmail.com to discuss this or any other meta topics of interest. Thanks again, and goodbye.